From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
On this 50th anniversary of my parents' execution, I choose to celebrate their resistance rather than mourn their fate.
50 years ago today, the most famous execution in U.S. history, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg died in the electric chair in Sing Sing. Today we speak with their children, Robert and Michael Mirapol, their grandchild Rachel, and their co-defendant, Morton Sobel.
I am Morton Sobel. I was tried with Julius and Ethel on the one count, conspiracy to commit espionage. The only reason I am here today and not electrocuted is that the government, despite all their efforts, could not pin the atomic bomb part of the conspiracy on me.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. For the first time, a top Pentagon official has admitted the U.S. is now fighting a, quote, guerrilla war in Iraq. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz told Congress yesterday, quote, there's a guerrilla war there, but we can win it. The Financial Times reports Wolfowitz's comments reflect efforts by the White House to prepare the nation for a longer and more hazardous fight in Iraq than was anticipated. Wolfowitz's comments come after it was revealed a U.S. soldier was killed in a drive-by shooting in a Baghdad gas station. 52 soldiers have now died in Iraq since President Bush announced the end of the major combat on May 1st. Meanwhile, up to 30,000 troops from countries including Italy, Spain, and the Ukraine plan to arrive in Iraq in mid-August to replace some of the U.S. forces. And U.S. officials have announced they've captured Saddam Hussein's top aide, Abdelhamid Mahmoud al-Tikriti. Only Saddam and his sons are higher on the Pentagon's wanted list. One official described him to the Los Angeles Times as, quote, the Condoleezza Rice of the Ba'ath Party. Officials in Washington are hoping he will provide information on whether Saddam Hussein is alive and, if so, his whereabouts. A former director of Central Intelligence has accused the administration of George Bush of, quote, overstretching the facts about Iraq's weapons program to justify the invasion of Iraq. Stansfield Turner, who headed the CIA under President Carter, said, quote, there is no question in my mind that policymakers distorted the situation, either because they had bad intelligence or because they misrepresented it. Yesterday, the House and Senate Intelligence Committees began closed-door hearings on the intelligence that provided the basis for the U.S.-led attack on Iraq. Senator John Kerry said of President Bush, he misled every one of us. Pakistani President General Pervez Musharraf yesterday called for tens of thousands more international troops in Afghanistan to impose order outside Kabul. Musharraf said the force needs to be increased from the existing 14,000 soldiers to between 40 and 45,000. Almost all international troops are stationed in Kabul. Musharraf said things are not going as well as could be expected. Despite pressure from the United States, the UN nuclear watchdog agency decided yesterday not to pass a resolution condemning Iran for its nuclear program. The Bush administration maintains Iran is pursuing a nuclear weapons program. Mohammed El-Baradei, IAEA Secretary General, last week pressed Iran to agree to enhanced inspections after Iran refused to let inspectors enter an electricity plant, which is thought to be part of a uranium enrichment project. Meanwhile, President Bush warned Iran yesterday not to develop nuclear weapons. He also told anti-government protesters in Iran that, quote, America stands squarely by their side. An Israeli died in the village of Trumat near the West Bank after a Palestinian suicide bomber blew himself up in an Israeli grocery store. This came a day after a 7-year-old Israeli girl was shot dead in a highway ambush. Israeli officials blame Palestinian gunmen for the killing. The Catholic Bishop of Phoenix, the Most Reverend Thomas O'Brien, has resigned after being charged with leaving the scene of a fatal car accident. The accident came shortly after he admitted he'd shielded from prosecution priests accused of molesting minors. The Washington Post reports O'Brien's the first bishop in the United States ever to resign in the face of criminal charges and the first to ever be charged with a felony. The Census Bureau yesterday announced Latinos are now the nation's largest minority group. According to the census, the nation's Latino population in July 2002 was 38.8 million, about half a million larger than the African-American population. And a new report by Amnesty International has found the U.S. locks up more than 5,000 children a year who enter the country illegally and alone. They're often held in harsh conditions without access to lawyers. Amnesty reports some are jailed with criminals, strip-searched, shackled, physically abused. This all comes in violation of a 1985 U.S. court ruling that children in immigration custody must be treated with, quote, dignity, respect, and special concern for their vulnerability as minors. Amnesty went on to say children from all over the world, from toddlers to teens, are held for months and sometimes years while U.S. authorities decide whether to grant them political asylum or humanitarian resettlement. The New York Times is reporting the White House has rewritten a major report by the Environmental Protection Agency in order to delete data on global warming. Among other things, the White House removed references that concluded global warming is caused in part by rising concentrations of smokestack and automobile emissions. And finally, in Benton Harbor, Michigan, more than 300 police officers took to the streets following two nights of riots. Officers who came from Benton Harbor, neighboring communities, and Michigan State Police were in riot gear armed with semi-automatic weapons and tear gas launchers. A state of emergency has been declared in the city after violence erupted following the death of a 27-year-old African-American man named Terrence Sturm, who was killed in a police chase. Hundreds of residents took to the streets, smashing windows, overturning cars, and settling buildings ablaze. One person was shot, 15 injured, as cops in riot gear tried to control the crowds. Earlier today, we spoke with Alex Kotlowitz. He went to Benton Harbor as a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, ended up writing a book about the death of Eric McGinnis, a 16-year-old African-American from Benton who dated a white girl and used to frequent a nightclub on the St. Joseph side of the river, a white town. Eric disappeared while fleeing police. 5 days later, his body was found floating in the river. The book was called The Other Side of the River, looked at the case from the perspective of these racially divided communities. I asked him to talk about his thoughts on Benton Harbor today.
Benton Harbor is a community that is desperately poor. It's a community in which work has virtually disappeared, a community in which the underground economy flourishes in the guise of the drug trade, and as a result, it's a been wrecked by violence, black-on-black violence. In fact, in the early 90s, it had the highest per capita murder rate in the country. It is not an easy place to live, to raise a family. And on top of everything else, it's a community that is just terribly spiritually and geographically isolated. I mean, I think of Benton Harbor as kind of one of our forgotten communities. It's a place that we have no reason to pay any attention to, except, of course, when we have such things as what happened earlier this week.
Can you talk about what sparked this?
Well, and what sparked it was a chase of a motorcyclist, is my understanding. But I am certain that it must go far beyond that. I can't imagine that people would take to the streets over one incident, and over an incident in which there's clearly some ambiguity about what happened. And I know when I was there that there had been a long simmering sense of distrust, if not anger, towards the criminal justice system from the courts on down, a sense that that residents in Benton Harbor had at times been treated unfairly. And I think those memories linger.
You write about the death of Eric McGinnis, the 16-year-old African-American teen from Benton. What happened to him, and how did that affect the feelings in Benton Harbor?
Right. Well, it's up in the air. Nobody really knows for sure what happened to Eric McGinnis. But what we do know is that Eric, who was 16 years old, had been attending a teenage white club in St. Joseph, the white town on the other side of the river, on a Friday night and was shooting off some firecrackers with some white friends and apparently broke into a car and jimmied open a glove compartment to take to steal $30, and the owner of the car caught him, and a chase ensued. And the owner of the car chased Eric away from the river past an off-duty deputy sheriff, and Eric disappeared. And 5 days later, his body was found floating in the river that separates the two communities. And what so drew me to Eric's death was how these two towns, one white and the other black, came to the death of this boy from such extraordinarily different perspectives. Virtually everybody in St. Joe, the white town, was, still is, convinced that Eric died an accidental death, that he knew the police were out looking for him and so chose to swim the river to get home rather than go over the bridge and accidentally drowned. And virtually everybody in Benton Harbor was and still is convinced that Eric died as a result of foul play, most likely at the hands of whites, because he had been dating a white girl. And it's a sort of very peculiar American Rashomon that has everything to do with race, our place in the world.
Alex Kotlowitz, author of The Other Side of the River, about Benton Harbor, Michigan. You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Juan Gonzalez.
And good day to all of our listeners and viewers around the country. And Amy, we've got a great show today. I just want to underline one of the headlines that you read about the EPA. It's an astounding story that the New York Times has today that actually indicates that the White House was directly forcing scientists at the EPA to rewrite sections of a report, and that the scientists have leaked both all the different versions, both their original version as well as the White House censorship of it. And so we're seeing that this move toward environmental fascism, what it is in this country, that there's enormous resistance within the EPA to it.
I'm just waiting, Juan, for the weathermen and women around the country, since so much of news is devoted to weather, for them to once mention those two words, global warming. Well, today is a very important day. It was 50 years ago today, on June 19th, 1953, at just about 8 o'clock in the evening, that Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were executed in the electric chair in Sing Sing. Today we're going to spend the hour with their sons, Robert and Michael Meeropol, their co-defendant, Morton Sobel, and their granddaughter, Rachel Meeropol. But first, we're going to go back to the first report I ever did here at WBAI Radio. And it was June 19th, 1985. And it was covering a protest outside of the courthouse here in New York. We'll go to the tape.
Shall know, my sons shall know, why we leave this song unsung. The book unread, the work undone, to rest beneath the sod.
Sung by Richard Corey, these are the words of Ethel Rosenberg, written a few months before she and her husband Julius died in the electric chair June 19, 1953, executed for conspiracy to commit espionage. On Wednesday, a demonstration was held at Foley Square in front of the United States Courthouse, where the Rosenbergs were tried 32 years ago, and where their judge, Irving Kaufman, still sits. Afterwards, a memorial service was held at the Stephen Wise Free Synagogue, sponsored by the Committee to Reopen the Rosenberg Case. Many of the speakers called on the House Judiciary Committee of the United States Congress to set up a commission of inquiry to reinvestigate the case. In the past 10 years, 160,000 pages of previously classified information pertaining to the Rosenbergs have been released. But according to Marshall Perlin, one of the Rosenbergs' defense lawyers, there remain close to 1 million pages yet undisclosed. Rabbi Robert Goldberg has written an article on the Rosenbergs, calling the trial a flaunting of justice.
Let the Rosenberg case be reexamined, not alone for the reputation of those who died or for their children, but for the conscience of this nation. As Justice Felix Frankfurter wrote after the executions, history also has its claims.
But it is not only vindicating history that the speakers were concerned with. Attorney Marshall Perlin, who will be going to court in September for the release of more documents, sees history repeating itself.
We have to remember that the same people who are sending the troops down to Honduras the same people that were involved in Iran, in Greece, in Guatemala, and in Vietnam, are the same people with the same rationale of anti-communism, hysteria, and fear, the same people and the same policies that killed Ethel and Julius Rosenberg 32 years ago.
Ethel Rosenberg Appel, Julius Rosenberg's sister.
This May 12th would have been my brother's 66th birthday. My cry has always been, and always will be, there never was any evidence against the Rosenbergs. There's none today, because no evidence ever existed.
Work and build, my sons, and build a monument to love and joy, to human worth, to faith we kept. For you, my sons, for you.
That report from June 19th, 1985. Today, June 19th, 2003, is the 50th anniversary of the execution of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. We go first to their sons, Robert and Michael Mirapol. Robert has just written a new book called An Execution in the Family, One Son's Journey. Robert Mirapol, son of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you for having me.
Michael Mirapol on the line with us in Springfield, Massachusetts. Welcome, Michael, as well.
Pleased to be here.
Well, let's begin with you, Robert. Your memory, how old you were, your memory of those times.
Well, I was six 50 years ago. My parents were arrested shortly after my third birthday. I have very little memories of our life with them beforehand, just a general good feeling. I remember visiting them in prison, but I can't say I remember particular prison visits. Probably my best memory comes from the last week of their lives. There was a kind of a Supreme Court roller coaster ride. First they were scheduled to die, then there was a stay of execution, then the execution date was reimposed. And as a six-year-old, I thought that the attorney was asked by the Supreme Court judges to give 10 reasons why my parents shouldn't be killed, and he did, so the execution was stayed. But then they asked him for an 11th reason, and he was unable to, and so they were killed. I think I confused repeated references to 11th hour appeals with, you know, an 11th reason. But, you know, I really got the essence. They'd killed my parents.
Michael Mirapol, you were older. How old were you?
I was 10 at the time.
What did you understand from the time of your parents' arrest until they were executed?
Well, the first night after my father was arrested, I stayed up late and listened to a radio broadcast, and my father's arrest was on the radio. And I don't remember exactly how, I actually knew right from the start that they faced the death penalty. And my seven-year-old self created what I called a nightmare prediction, which went through a whole bunch of stages, trials, appeals, etc. And as I followed through, like I was eight and then I was nine and I heard about things, I would learn that there were appeals. And then later on, when I was eight and nine, I learned about the clemency fight, so I sort of put that into the mix. But the nightmare prediction was always, you know, we could lose all of those, and there would be this terrible event at the end of the line. And, of course, 1953, June 19th, Robbie and I are watching a baseball game, and the TV keeps being interrupted with all these bulletins, and there it was, the nightmare prediction playing out right on the screen.
And, Robert Mirapol, what happened in the ensuing years with your brother and yourself? Where were you raised? And those years after the loss of your parents, how did you develop?
Well, we went through a pretty bad time for 4 years, but we were ultimately adopted by Abel and Ann Mirapol. Abel Mirapol, the author of The Words and Music of Strange Fruit, Billie Holiday's song. And we were raised in their household. Our names were changed so that we could have more normal lives. And we dropped from public sight for 20 years. And it wasn't until the early 1970s that we resurfaced and began a massive effort to reopen our parents' case.
You, in fact, were put into foster care, is that right? Or put into a home for a while?
Well, we were The relatives on both sides of the family, after my parents' arrest, were quite frightened. It was the McCarthy period. Nobody would take us in. We did get first shipped to my mother's house, Tessie Greenglass, but she was supporting my parents' chief accuser, my mother's younger brother, David Greenglass. And to increase the pressure on my parents, she actually dumped us in a shelter. So we did spend 6 months there. And after, even after we were connected with Abel and Ann Mirapol, right-wingers tried to take us away from them. And we were actually seized by New York City police in 1954 and for a short period of time placed in an orphanage.
Why take you away?
Because the lawyer, Manny Block, my parents' attorney, died of a heart attack before he could finalize the adoption proceedings, you know, our legal adoption. And so the Mirapols weren't really our legal guardians. And they, but the real reason they wanted to take us away was because they didn't want me to grow up, and they didn't want Michael to grow up to do what we did, fight for our parents' name and ultimately for me start the Rosenberg Fund for Children.
We have to break for stations for 60 seconds, and we're going to use this opportunity to play Abel Mirapol's song. Many think Billie Holiday actually wrote it, but she sang it, and she said that every time she would sing this song, she would throw up afterwards. This is Abel Mirapol's Strange Fruit.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root, black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar tree. Sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for the tree.
Billie Holiday singing Strange Fruit by Abel Mirapol, the adoptive father of Michael and Robert Rosenberg Mirapol. It is the song about lynching in the South, Strange Fruit hanging from the poplar trees. You are listening to Democracy Now! On this 50th anniversary of the execution of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Our guests are Robert Mirapol, who has just published his memoir, An Execution in the Family, One Son's Journey. This follows a book that he and his older brother, Michael Mirapol, wrote called We Are Your Sons, The Legacy of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg. We're also joined in the studio by Morton Sobel, who is the co-defendant of the Rosenbergs. Juan?
Well, Robert, you mentioned in the previous segment both David Greenglass and the battle within the family that developed as a result of the some members of the family giving evidence against the other. Could you talk a little bit about the impact of that on the family, and also begin to lay out what it was that you sought to disprove or to rectify in terms of justice, in terms of your parents?
Well, Basically, what happened once David and Ruth Greenglass were offered a deal, the same deal my parents were offered, which is confess, say what we want you to say, name others who were involved, the man would get a prison sentence and the woman would get to go home and take care of the kids. And David and Ruth Greenglass also had two children. And they took the deal. And Ruth was never indicted, never spent a day in prison. Now, that was a complete break with the family. I've never had any contact with any of them. And even with the Rosenberg family, because it was difficult because family members were scared to take us in. So, but they were supportive by and large. I think it's probably not a coincidence that the male members of both families were the ones who were supported, that the Greenglass family supported the Greenglass son, and the Rosenberg family supported the Rosenberg son, but less publicly, though, with some exceptions. So that's the family history, and I do have some connection with the Rosenberg side of the family, but nothing with the Greenglass side. In terms of what we tried to do, I grew up as a teenager emotionally convinced of my parents' innocence. As a young man, I read what I could, and then we started a massive Freedom of Information Act and forced the release of all those pages that were talked about at the top of the hour. And those documents and other research showed that the prosecutor collaborated with the judge, that they were working as a team, showed that the witnesses lied, showed that evidence was fabricated, showed that essentially it was a frame-up, and that my parents didn't do, and this is what I think is the critical question in my parents' case, did they commit the act they were killed for, which was not conspiracy to commit espionage, but was stealing the atomic bomb.
And for those listeners who are not familiar with the case, could you lay out what the government's basic case against them was?
Well, the government's basic case was that David Greenglass was working at Los Alamos, where the bomb was being fabricated in New Mexico, as a sergeant in the Army during World War II, as a machinist. And the government's case was very simple. Julius Rosenberg was a spy working for the KGB. He found out somehow that Greenglass was involved in this secret project, and he recruited him to provide information. And Greenglass then testified that that was correct, and that there was a spy courier named Harry Gold who transmitted the information between Los Alamos and New York. That's the core of the case.
And the secrets supposedly being passed on were about the atom bomb.
Yeah, a few sketches, a cross-section of the bomb, a couple of other sketches. And, you know, looking back on it now, it's so absurd. As one atomic scientist later put it, and by the way, you'd think that there would be a parade of atomic scientists at the trial testifying, you know, of how valuable this was, but none were called. But years later, as one atomic scientist put it, building the atomic bomb was an industry, not a recipe.
We're also joined in the studio by Morton Sobel, and he was the co-defendant of the Rosenbergs. They lived in New York. You were picked up in Mexico City, Morton Sobel.
Well, I was illegally abducted from Mexico City by the Mexican security police and taken to the border, where I was then formally arrested by the FBI. And, of course, they had two FBI agents who played the good guy, bad guy routine and told me I faced the death penalty unless I confessed. And they worked on me for a while, and then I went before a judge and went up to New York, where I thought I would have good legal advice as to how to proceed.
What did they charge you with?
This has to be clarified. Judith, Ethel, and I were all charged with one single count, conspiracy to commit espionage. It was not treason, even though you will find in half of the reference books that we were charged with treason. And even the New York Times makes that error once in a while, and then I have to send in a letter of correction, and they correct it. But the reason that the treason thing came up is that during the trial, the prosecution kept yelling, treason, treason, treason. And it so happens treason is the only crime defined in the Constitution with a method of proof proscribed to, and for good reason. So we were all tried together, but the government, the only witness they had against me was Max Elitcher, who testified that I wanted him to join the conspiracy to get some naval secrets. And the reason I'm here and alive today is that the prosecution was afraid that if they gave me the death penalty, I might have a reversal because the evidence was so flimsy and it didn't involve the atom bomb. And as a matter of fact, I did have a 2-1 decision in the Court of Appeals where Jerome Frank said I should never have been tried with Julius and Ethel. And they tried us together because Julius and Ethel tried together as conspiracy wouldn't fly very well. A husband and wife don't make a conspiracy. So they added me to the conspiracy. And they kept from me the information that I would not be charged with atomic conspiracy until the actual trial itself. Until then, I thought I was going to be charged with atomic conspiracy because that's what all the newspapers had.
Well, let's go to that issue of the charging of Ethel Rosenberg along with Julius Rosenberg. And also, and this is instructive for younger people who may not be familiar with the case or older people who they know the names but never even knew what the charges were. At this time, again, the Soviet Union was an ally of the United States. At the time of the trial, however, was the Cold War and was then an enemy of the United States. But the time they were charged with taking these secrets, the Soviet Union an ally?
Yes, the charge was during World War II, though there was one incident that they sort of plugged in, and there was some question about whether they actually changed the date on some evidence in order to make it. That was September 2nd, 1945. And that date is really critical because it's 1 month after the end of World War II. So they tried to deal with that problem.
But this issue of Ethel being brought into this case, mm-hmm. and then we'll go to Roy mm-hmm. Cohn, who became famous as the top aide to McCarthy, who was the assistant prosecutor mm-hmm. in the case against your parents and Mort Sobel.
Well, the FBI files indicate quite clearly that my mother was involved as part of a prosecution strategy to increase the pressure on my father. In fact, to this day, they refuse to release the minutes of the grand jury proceedings that led to my mother's arrest, probably because those proceedings show there was no evidence against her. As time went on, as we got closer to trial, it turned out that the prosecution witnesses were saying Ethel Rosenberg wasn't involved. So in order to involve her, they had to invent a story. And literally within a few weeks before the trial, first Ruth Greenglass and then David Greenglass changed their story and say Ethel was present during the espionage meetings that we had. She actually typed up Greenglass's handwritten notes that described these atomic bomb sketches. And so the amazing thing about that is even if the statement were true, that would mean that the United States executed someone for typing. But it turns out we knew it wasn't true. We knew it was an invention in order to get a conviction. And there are FBI documents that pretty much say that. But finally, David Greenglass admitted in 2001 on CBS that he lied when he said that Ethel was present and did the typing. So that was the final conclusive bit of evidence about my mother.
And in terms of the period in which this all unraveled, the events that they were convicted of conspiring around were in 1945, but the arrests actually occurred right around the time of the Korean War, didn't they? And could you talk a little bit about the times and the mood in the country?
Well, my parents' case is bracketed by the Korean War. They're arrested just after it starts, and they're killed just before it ends. This is the McCarthy period. This is the period where everybody is terrified of the international communist conspiracy that's about to destroy us all. This is the period where we say national security has to take precedence or priority over civil liberties.
And, of course, Morton Sobel, as you mentioned in your own book about the times, You were a former member of the Communist Party with Julius. You had gone to you attended City College together. So clearly, the government was very interested in tying you to some sort of illegal activity.
Well, not only me, but other members of the graduating class who had also been members of the Communist Party. It was actually the Young Communist League rather than the Communist Party that we were involved in at City College. And, of course, we did all this nefarious talking amongst ourselves and planning the overthrow of the government of the United States on paper. So it was, you know, the organization was a paper organization that, maybe we might have demonstrated once. But City College was really a hotbed at that time of activity. And one May Day, the strike flag, went up on a flagpole. The flagpole had been greased. And things like that took place to enliven the atmosphere.
You wrote a book about your experiences, Morton Sobel, called On Doing Time, and in it there is a CD-ROM of documents you got under the Freedom of Information
Act. Mike Perlin got them.
That was Marshall Perlin, Perlin, who was the attorney, your attorney. You also write about your time at Alcatraz, considered one of the best descriptions of what Alcatraz was all about and what was going on inside. How are you treated as one of the most famous defendants in U.S. history?
They treated me with kid gloves. They were afraid that other inmates might gang up and kill me. This I have learned from documents, which of course was not true. They thought other inmates would be such patriots that they would come after me. And this was absolutely not true. By that time, I'd been in prison already for 2 years, and I knew how to behave. And all I had to do was be very frank with the other men, not to ridicule them, even though what they might say. For instance, when they asked me about blowing up a safe, you know, I would treat that with all seriousness, and we would discuss it. So I achieved a certain status among the men as an intellectual. They knew that, you see. And the thing that was the worst part of Alcatraz was the isolation. No radio, no newspaper. I visited with my wife, Helen, who has since died, through a bulletproof glass with a telephone that they monitored. And I didn't, well, music, for instance, I didn't have any of that. And even the Jewish chaplain could not bring in visitors the way in other prisons. So it was the isolation that really took its toll. And I know because when I finally, after 5 years, transferred to Atlanta, It felt like as if I was out in the free world.
And you spent a total of 18 years in prison?
18 and a half, yeah. Yeah, right.
And you
right.
got out in 1960.
1969. Right.
I wanted to ask you, Robert Mirapol, about the evolution of your thinking about your parents. You talked about how at the beginning, first, what it meant to be. You weren't in hiding, incognito, I guess. Your name changed from Robert Rosenberg to Robert Mirapol. That's how you grew up, you and your brother. When did you come out as the son of you and Michael coming out as the sons? And Michael had to leave, by the way, as he makes his way up to New York to come to this big event you are having tonight at City Center, celebrating the lives of your parents.
And there's still tickets available. When I was in my 20s, as I said, I became intellectually convinced of my parents' complete and total innocence. But then I went to law school when I was in my 30s, and I realized all the evidence we have amassed and all that we have talked about proved that they were framed, proved that they didn't do the thing they were killed for. But did it prove that they were not involved in some sort of secret conspiracy? And, you know, that's, it's very, how do you disprove? How do you prove? How can I prove? How can you prove that you're not involved in a secret conspiracy? It's an almost impossible task. But that new insight enabled me to look with fresh eyes on all the evidence or all the material that has come out in the 1990s, probably the most potent of which is the Venona transcriptions that were released in the mid-1990s. These are secret transcriptions of supposed Soviet electronic transmissions that occurred during World War II, which had all these people listed under code names, and the government said the spy codenamed Antenna and then later Liberal was Julius Rosenberg. And I look at this material and I think it's suspect for a lot of reasons, but I can't disprove it. And that plus a whole bunch of other little things that are equally shaky in my mind lead me to believe that it's possible there's some truth there. It's possible that Julius Rosenberg was involved during World War II in helping the Soviet Union defeat the Nazis by transmitting helping to transmit non-atomic information. That's possible. Now, and I don't even think that's a particularly bad thing. But saying it's possible is the same as saying it might not have happened. I describe myself in the book as an agnostic on my father's guilt or innocence. But I also don't think that that's the key question. The key question is, did they do the thing they were killed for? And the answer is no. But for me personally, as my parents' son, I have to, if it's possible that somehow there was some involvement, how do I feel about that? How do I feel as a son? How do I feel as a father? How do I feel as someone who has started the Rosenberg Fund for Children, which provides for the educational and emotional needs of the children of targeted activists in this country whose parents might have engaged in somewhat similar activities? How does that affect me? And I come to the conclusion that whatever went on in the 1940s, it was not 1975, it was not 2003. The world was at war. People were choosing sides. Tens of thousands of young Americans and people all over the world were going off to war, leaving wives, leaving children, knowing they might not come back. And under those circumstances, I will not second guess what my parents did. I've always felt supremely loved by them, and I am very thankful for their legacy.
And of course, as it's hard for younger people these days to understand or realize it, during World War II, the United States and the Soviet Union were allied and were fighting together to defeat Nazism and the Axis. And in essence, even if they were involved in some sort of passing of information, it was a passing of information of citizens of allied countries, not of directly.
Well, and also one of the things you discover as you look at all this material that's come out, and you discover that atomic scientists, world-class atomic scientists, were sharing information during World War II. Many of them did not believe that it would be a good thing for the United States to have a nuclear monopoly. And I think, you know, all we have to do is look at, since the last 10 years or more, since the demise of the Soviet Union, the United States now is the only world superpower, and it has a terrible track record. Perhaps those scientists were right in what they did. And certainly the United States in the last few years has sort of, I think, added strength to that argument.
When we come back from our break, we'll also be joined by your daughter, the Rosenberg's granddaughter, who has continued to fight against McCarthyism today, specifically focusing on the issue of immigrants. But I raise the issue of Roy Cohn. Before I do it, Mort Sobel, you wanted to just say something.
Well, I take issue with the agnostic position that Robert takes. I am innocent. And my investigation of Venona leads me to believe, because I have the evidence, that Venona was a cooked-up job, and therefore, if the government had to cook up stuff to implicate Julius and Ethel, then I cannot be an agnostic. I say they are innocent.
And explain why it's called Venona for people who are just unfamiliar with these documents.
That's just the name of the
that
project.
That's all. It's just the name they gave it.
Like Operation Desert Scorpion there.
Mm-hmm. You see. But I have evidence that certain files were written one way before Julius was arrested, and after he was arrested, they changed them to implicate him. In fact, one file says that Antenna Liberal was a guy in Washington, living in Washington.
Named Weisbord.
Weisbord.
Yeah.
And then after Greenglass came out that Julius was guilty, they said, oh, we made a slight mistake. You see, now the rest of the stuff doesn't follow because the Antenna Liberal is supposed to have gone to Cooper Union. And Julius did not go to Cooper Union. But I have other files. And then when I wanted to get a whole sheaf of files before the arrest, the National Security Agency said, no, this will reveal a methodology of 1950 if we give you these files. And believe it or not, I couldn't get any legal aid. The ACLU turned me down, and in Washington they wanted me to fund it and stuff like that. So the thing was in abeyance. But here's a whole group of files we should show. I have some. But I wanted to take a whole sheaf of files to show how they changed them. And so Venona, to me, is a fraud.
We are going to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we'll also be joined by Rachel Mirapol. We're talking with Mort Sobel, co-defendant of the Rosenbergs, and Robert Mirapol, who's just finished a memoir called An Execution in the Family, One Son's Journey. Stay with us.
And just like the river, I've been running ever since. He said it's been a long time coming, but I know my change is gonna come.
Change is going to come. Aretha Franklin here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we continue on this special edition of Democracy Now!, the 50th anniversary of the execution of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. They were executed at 8 o'clock on June 19th, 1953. In fact, they were supposed to be executed at 11 p.m., not 3 hours earlier. But in respect, I think the judges said for the Jewish Sabbath, they executed them a minute before the sundown. Is that right?
Yeah, theory, the plan was to execute them a minute before sundown. But actually, my mother, who was executed second, it didn't work the first time. And so she had to be given a second jolt of electricity and by the time that happened, it was after sundown.
And thousands in New York, Union Square, gathered at that moment, as people did all over the country. Robert Mirapol, our guest, he is one of the Rosenberg sons. Mort Sobel is their co-defendant. And Rachel Mirapol also joins us, the daughter of Robert Mirapol and the grandchild of the Rosenbergs. We heard your father, Robert Mirapol, describe being incognito, really not telling anyone in his life, other his parents knew and a few of their close friends, who he was, that he was a Rosenberg, until he was an adult. When did you become aware, Rachel?
I don't remember actually ever becoming aware. It was something that I always knew, the way you know your name. I think that one of my first specific memories relating to the case centered actually on another anniversary of the execution. I was in first grade, and my teacher asked if any of the kids in the class knew of any holidays that happened in June. And I raised my hand and said, well, on June 19th in New York City, people celebrate my grandparents. And the teacher said, I'm sorry, I've never heard of that holiday, and probably called my parents immediately afterwards.
So what did you understand as you grew up? When did you come to investigate? When did you just emotionally understand? And then I want to ask Robert the difference in growing up where people don't know a part of who you are, and in your case, Rachel, where you always knew.
I think my initial understanding, I was always struck by the fact that they were offered this deal, and that the deal would be, you must confess, you must implicate others. I always grew up with a sense of pride in the fact that they refused to do that, that they refused to bring other people into the terrible situation that they had been placed in. And I think that was sort of the depth of my original understanding. Once I got to be 11 or 12, people started to ask me about it. Older people would come up to me, recognize my name, and want to engage me a little bit on the case. And I, of course, realized that I had to do some more research. I had to know some more facts, or else I was gonna, I was gonna feel stupid not being able to provide people with information. I wanted to always be able to have an answer, always want to be able to explain sort of my emotional understanding and also my intellectual understanding of the injustice.
And, well, Robert, the stand that your parents took obviously had an impact, a moral impact on you throughout your life. You've been socially active in various causes, if you mentioned some in the past. Now Rachel has continued in the same manner. Could you talk a little bit about that, about the impact of their stand on your activities as an adult?
Well, there was a community of support that rallied to my aid, and I guess I was always a political animal. I'm not quite sure where it came from, whether it's my parents' case or it was in my genes. But at the Mirapol household, TV was very closely rationed, but we all watched all these news shows on Sunday morning. And I watched them with them as an 8 and 9 year old, and I didn't have to be coaxed. I wanted to. But it seemed to me that this heritage was something that taught me that resistance was particularly important, and that's something that has stayed with me in my entire life. Amy asked the question about the difference between me and Rachel and whether we being anonymous. I grew up in high school, in particular, in fear of being exposed.
Toms River, New Jersey.
Well, that was Toms River, where I was thrown out of public school when I was 6, but I grew up in Westchester. I went to Hastings High School, and I was scared that people would find out who I was. They never did, which is very lucky, I think. Rachel, on the other hand, I think they grew up, Rachel and her sister Jen, they both grew up with it being a natural thing. It's just who they were.
In fact, you came out when your older child was just born.
Yeah,
is that
she was
right?
About 2. Rachel wasn't even born yet.
And you did this because you were suing author of a book that you felt...
He stole my parents' prison correspondence, which had been copyrighted. He published it without permission.
Louis Nizer.
Yes, and that forced us to sue or lose the copyright. I mean, there were other elements to the lawsuit, but that's how we came out. I'd like to say it was some sort of political crusade, but we sort of backed into it, but I certainly don't regret it.
And Rachel, could you talk a little bit about the activities that you've been involved in now with the Center for Constitutional Rights and the battle over the government's treatment of INS detainees?
Rachel is an attorney now.
Absolutely. I've been spending my first year post-law school working on a couple cases at the center. The first is Turkman v. Ashcroft, which is the center's challenge to the post-9/11 detentions. We've recently amended our complaint in that case based on the Office of the Inspector General report that came out about a week ago, 2 weeks ago, actually. The report details government illegality post-9/11 and sort of fills in the details that were secret until now about how non-citizens were sort of targeted based on racial profiling and anonymous tips, and then caught up in extremely restrictive conditions, kept detained for months on end with basically no evidence of any connection to terrorism, any risk of flight, any dangerousness. I'm also working on putting together a class action challenging the conditions of confinement at Passaic County Jail, which is a county jail in New Jersey that holds upwards of about 100 non-citizens at any time on contract with the INS. The facility is just disgusting. The INS immigrants are held in really repulsive conditions, crowded into cells with roaches and three-level bunk beds, subject to brutality. So we're trying to put together this suit. I think that really non-citizens today are viewed the way communists were viewed in the 50s. You know, everyone's a terrorist. Everyone's a member of Al-Qaeda.
And Morton Sobel, as you hear what Rachel's involved in now, the witch hunt that led to your being in prison for 18 years, any thoughts for Americans about the current witch hunt that is going on?
Yes, I've spoken about a comparison between the witch hunt today and McCarthyism, and I say today is much, much worse. For instance, during McCarthyism, the FBI had prepared a list of 20,000 communists to be picked up overnight and put into the concentration camps where the Japanese had been kept. They also prepared a brief for the Supreme Court to suspend habeas corpus. So they wanted to keep the forms proper. They wanted a legal basis for suspending habeas corpus. The gang today doesn't even go to court to suspend. They suspend habeas corpus without any leave of the courts. So in that sense, it's closer to fascism than it ever was during the McCarthy period. And also during the McCarthy period, the guy out front, McCarthy, eventually he got sat on when he went too far. And today, it's the gang in the White House that doesn't have anybody out front. They're the ones that are out front leading the charge. And that makes it all the more desperate.
As we wrap up tonight, a large event here in New York at City Center, Harry Belafonte, Susan Sarandon, Pete Seeger, most importantly, the Rosenberg family, the Mirapoles, Robert and Michael Mirapole, Rachel and Jen Mirapole, as well as the children of Michael Mirapole
and
others.
Ivy and Gregory.
Ivy, who working on a film on this issue. And that's at the City Center. People can still go.
Yes,
get tickets.
There are still tickets available, and we are...
What time?
7:30 tonight, and we're celebrating resistance because it's never been more important to celebrate resistance.
And the name of your organization, Robert Mirapole?
The Rosenberg Fund for Children.
Which helps children of political activists who've been detained or killed or
fired.
Have been fired or harassed. I want to thank you all for being with us on this, well, what did you call it, Rachel? What did you tell your teacher this day is?
A holiday? A celebration of my grandparents.
Thank you, Rachel Mirapole, Robert Mirapole, and Morton Sobel, Michael Mirapole as well. That does it for the show. If you want to get a video copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. You can go to our website, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Chris Abrams, Angie Karen, Anna Nogara, Sharif Abdelkaddous. Also, thanks to Noah Reibel, Vilka Tsouris, Mike DeFilippo. I'm Amy Goodman Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for being with us.
Mercy, mercy.